Concession, this court has got. Am I on mute or off mute? Can you hear me? You can hear me. Thank you. So we are back in session and today's date is July 22nd, 2020. I see counsel for the second matter on our calendar. I will ask the marshal to call the case.
The Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratvold, Judge Smith, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Judge Bratvold presiding. And the case number A19-2082, 40 Ventures LLC Appellant versus Minisquam LLC et al. Respondents.
All right, and I'll make just a couple of quick remarks before we go ahead with the arguments. First of all, I want to remind everyone and let you know, counsel, that we will follow this practice as well. The judges will tend to put their microphone on mute, and that's just to make sure that our sound quality is as good as possible. So I encourage you to do likewise while you are not presenting. And then, of course, we will ask questions and unmute our microphones. So as you begin your remarks, if you would please identify yourself for the record. We do make a recording and we use it often, and it is very much appreciated if you identify yourself as well as the client you represent. And then keep an eye on the clock. That clock should be visible to you now. The marshal has positioned an iPhone and will indicate 15 minutes at the beginning of your argument and count down. And then if the appellant chooses, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So with that, I think we're ready to proceed. And counsel for appellant, you can begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Chris Maddle for 40 Ventures, and may it please the court. Your Honors, I would like to divide my argument into three kind of primary sections where I think the major disagreements are. The first one is whether or not MnSTAT 322B-303 immunizes the conduct here. The second, I would like to talk about that direct derivative distinction. And then third, I'd like to talk about the district court's dismissal of our tortious interference claim. So first, with respect to the district court's decision that Minnesota Statute 322B.303 subdivision 1, it's a mouthful, immunizes the conduct here. And Your Honors, that statute is the same statute that we all learned in law school that is really a codification of the normal law that applies to corporations as well as limited liability companies, that shareholders are not responsible for the debts or obligations of a corporation. It does not immunize agreements by and between the members. And in fact, Minnesota Statute 322B88, as well as Minnesota Statute 322B37, both specifically acknowledge that there can be enforcement actions between members that happen here. 88 specifically says, except for proceedings that involve a claim of personal liability or responsibility of that member, and that claim has some basis other than the member's status as a member. 37 talks about member control agreements specifically, and it says those are enforceable. So now the district court said, looking at that last sentence of 3.1 of the member control agreement here, which says that except for matters requiring supermajority approval, any action approved by the requisite percentage shall be deemed an action of the Board of Governors. The district court said, well, geez, that was really what you're really complaining about is something on behalf of the Board of Governors. So therefore, you are just suing somebody because of their status as a member. And that's just not what we've alleged. And that's just not what this case is about. What we are alleging is a breach of the member control agreement where these defendants undertook specific personal obligations not to impede my client's supermajority voting rights.
Counsel, may I ask though, Am I wrong that every breach of contract claim cited section 0.3.3, which in your complaint, which is a supermajority approval section?
You are correct, Your Honor.
So how you said that it's a misunderstanding to believe that the breach of contract is a violation of the supermajority approval rule. How is that if that in fact is cited as the basis for every breach of contract claim? What's wrong with saying that?
So, Your Honor, I'm sorry, and then maybe I was being unclear. What the district court said is that the actions of these defendants were just wearing a Board of Governors hat. And because they were wearing a Board of Governors hat, it was immunized under 303. What we're saying is that no, they undertook individual personal responsibilities not to usurp, expropriate, or extinguish my client's supermajority rights. And when you look at that last sentence of section 3.1 in the member control agreement, it specifically says, except for matters requiring supermajority approval, any action approved by the requisite percentage shall be deemed an action of the board of directors. Well, except means other than, it means leave out, it means take away. If you take away those supermajority rights, it means something other than what the Board of Governors did. And what we're saying is that we should be able to sue for that. And if I might, Your Honors, just by way of a brief hypothetical or analogy, if the three of Your Honors came up with a new substitute, a great new product for aspirin, and you started an LLC, I come in after the product is developed, I put in some money, I get 51% ownership. And our operating agreement or a member control agreement, whatever you want to call it, says whatever Mattel comes up with, each one of you can veto it. I then convene a meeting of the board of directors. And I say, this is a meeting of the board of governors, board of directors, whatever you want to call it. And I'm wearing my board of governors hat. And I say, I don't care about your veto. I'm doing it. I'm dissolving the company. Under the district court and the appellee's argument, I win. 303 immunized everything that I did because I was wearing my board of governors hat.
But you aren't suing. Your client isn't suing. You keep talking about as if there's one entity that's wearing two hats. In fact, there's a member defendant who appoints a governor who is a person. It's not a person wearing two hats. It's an entity and the governor. So isn't that a difference?
I respectfully know, Your Honor, because if I'm designating somebody, it really doesn't matter if I'm designating, if John Montague designated 40 Ventures, he designated himself, or frankly, my daughter. The right belongs to 40 Ventures. The supermajority right under this agreement specifically provided that 40 Ventures owns that right. So in my hypothetical, if I am sitting there as a member of my, you know, Chris Mattel LLC, I was my own designated. Everybody, every entity has to run through a person. I can ignore all of your vetoes and say, I'm going to dissolve the company. Doesn't really matter what your operating agreement says.
You're Mr. Mattel, can I just follow up on that? So using your hypothetical, let's assume a bad assumption that you're estranged from your daughter and she makes decisions without your say, without your control, you have no say whatsoever. Isn't that precisely the limitation that you would want as a member under that scenario?
And I'm sorry, your camera just went gone there. So it's a, would I want a limitation that constrain my daughter to vote my way? Yes, of course. You know, of course I would want that. But John Montague was the only member. It was a single member LLC. And in this agreement, they designated and they agreed that John Montague was going to be the designee for 40 Ventures. So what I'm hopefully trying to make my point is that it doesn't matter what hat you're wearing here. What matters is what the agreement requires and whether or not it was breached. And 303 does not immunize anybody. In fact, this court has said the same thing with respect to personal guarantees.
So under your theory, then, if I'm understanding, either 40 Ventures or John Montague could have sued either any of the members or any of the governors. There's no reason to distinguish on either side of the versus, a member from a governor.
Your Honor, the only parties to this agreement were 40 Ventures and the members. And if I recall correctly, that there was a provision in there which specifically said that there are no third-party beneficiaries to the contract. So 40 Ventures held the supermajority right. That was the right that was extinguished here.
Have a breach of contract, it has to be member v. member. I want to get back to your reliance on section 3.1. Another way to read 3.1 is basically to say that it's majority rule according to your voting percentage, except when a supermajority is required.
Well,
you seem to read something different from that to suggest that, I guess, majority rule decisions are the only ones that are actions of the Board of Governors, and otherwise supermajority approval decisions are not an action of the corporation. I'm not quite following what a supermajority approval would be by the governing board, if not an action of the ExitNet Corporation, the LLC.
It's the company. And I understand, Your Honor, but if you are concentrating on the language, except for matters requiring supermajority approval, any action approved by the requisite percentage shall be deemed an action of the Board of Governors. Well, if except means other than, so other than matters of supermajority approval, it shouldn't be an action of the Board of Governors. I mean, otherwise, why wouldn't they have just said any action approved by the requisite percentage shall be acceptable?
Because the requisite percentage might just be majority rule, and it's saying no, in some things you need supermajority rule. So majority rule, it's an action of the Board of Governors. If it's supermajority, you're saying, well, we should read that to mean for things requiring supermajority that it's not an action of the Board of Governors. And I'm wondering, what is it then? If the Board of Governors rules and makes a decision on behalf of the company by an appropriate supermajority, we'll assume. I know you're not assuming that in this case, and we don't assume in this case. It's not an action of the board anymore?
It's an action. If you look at 3.3, the following decisions relating to the company require supermajority approval. It's certainly an action that relates to the company, but it's a board decision plus, and it's a special situation for those 36 enumerated items. That has to be a different mechanism other than the Board of Governors. It's not an action of the Board of Governors. It's a different framework. That's why they did this. And that's why I literally do not understand how, if you have an agreement between people where they extinguish that, why can't I sue for that? I mean, that it is a promise that I think it's stipulated that they violated. In fact, they came to us with a separation agreement that asked us to waive those rights. They asked us to waive a designation. We pled all of that. So they knew that they were acting contrary to that very agreement by asking us for that separation agreement.
So under your theory, then, if the governors appoint a CEO of the company by a supermajority, which is the A under 3.3, that's no longer, the board has not appointed that CEO, only the members have. The Board of Governors has not appointed a CEO.
The CEO was appointed by way of the supermajority, and that relates to the company. But it was not a Board of Governors decision. It couldn't have been a Board of Governors decision because the supermajority approval specifically has things outside of that Board of Governors process. That's in the definition of supermajority approval. I think two pages back means the approval of at least one of the JABJO and the 40 board designees and at least two of Minisquam, Lund, and Waitrust. It is different than the board.
So you're suggesting that this company is run by, in part, by a Board of Governors, but then in part by the members and not the Board of Governors for everything under 3.3, which look like, actually, of course, not surprisingly, the most important things since they're the supermajority. Those are not run by the Board of Governors. They're run by the members, the entities that are the members. Is that right?
And if you look at page 6 of the member control agreement and you look at the definition of supermajority approval, it specifically says that. It says that it's done by 40 Ventures and JABJO's designees, not necessarily by the Board of Governors. In fact, the designee could be somebody different than somebody on the Board of Governors. That is theoretically possible. So
I was going to ask that. So there could be five other people that the members appoint that actually do the most important things for this company than the Board of Governors. And you think that's consistent then with 3.2 because you would read that as a limit on the 3.2.
And accept, yes. Yes.
Does that mean, let's assume that you did not have supermajority provisions, but everything else was the same, meaning your client, if perhaps they didn't notify your client somehow, he didn't get to take part, et cetera. Is that your definition and understanding of the definition, I should say, of the supermajority clause, which separates it from actions of the board, That's what distinguishes this case from the hypothetical I'm suggesting, wherein there would be limited liability and no breach of contract. Your point being, because it's separate, that understanding is what takes it outside of the limitation otherwise that members would have for the actions of the board, because it was actually members who made the decision via the supermajority definition that you've described today.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, to answer just briefly, yes, that is exactly what makes this a unique case. And that's why we pled that time and time again about how very unique of a situation it is. I've never seen a member control agreement that had 36 separate things that had to go through this altogether different procedure outside of the board process in order to be approved with respect to that. But that's exactly why Montague and Parker wanted this, because this had happened once before to them and they wanted to protect themselves. And what's happened with these defendants is that they've just ignored it. They just got rid of it. So quickly, I've 45 seconds here with respect to the direct derivative distinction. If you read Blum, Blum gave away 1,200 acres of real property in that decision. This was not even brought up by the district court. That company was taken altogether. The entire asset was taken away. If you read Your Honor's decision in part one A talked about injury. The injury there was exclusion from the decision-making authority. Then you went to part 1B, which talked about damages. What the district court did here, they ignored. We repeatedly put into this complaint our injury. In fact, it's in paragraphs 10 and 11, was the loss of the supermajority voting rights. Our damages then would be the difference, would be the loss, diminution, and the value, which is exactly what Your Honors did in Blum. And I see my time is up, so I'll stop.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose. So the marshal is resetting the clock. And it looks like counselor respondent, we are ready for you. You can begin when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, David Marshall, Frederickson and Byron, representing the defendants. We start with section 3.3, which refers to supermajority approval. Supermajority approval is defined, as we just discussed, on page 6. Supermajority approval says that the board members that are designated by JABCO and by 40 Ventures, either one of them, and then two of the other four board members must vote to approve in a supermajority context. It is a vote of the board. The fact that it refers to the designees of the members is of no consequence. It's saying that the governors vote for those particular things. Nowhere in here does it discuss the members themselves voting. Similar to that, this section.
I think, counsel, if we just focus on the words, since it's the contract that we're focused on, I think when we look at 3.1, it talks about voting and percentages, and then we have the accept clause at the end. The next one says that the business and affair 3.2, the business and affairs of the company will be managed by the Board of Governors, subject to the limitations set forth in this agreement. And then sub 3 talks about supermajority approval without saying who provides a vote in that. And your opposing counsel says, hey, that could have been a whole nother set of 5 people who were the designees, although it doesn't mention designees either. I don't know how the members are exactly. It doesn't say who is making the vote. You would argue, I would assume, it's implicit from it that it's the Board of Governors. But talk to us about why.
The definition of supermajority refers to board designees. The supermajority section that defines supermajority approval on page 6, those designees are board designees. That's the definition. It's not some group of designees that are disconnected from the company somehow. That is the board.
So that's where we would look at the definition of supermajority approval, which is the board designees, which you mean to read to mean the governors. And now, I guess we'll hear from the other side about whether a governor, which is defined as a person serving on a board, has to be the same. You're saying the governor is a designee, and
yes,
they're
course.
Saying it can be two people.
Yeah, it can't be two people. These entities under this agreement, it's not uncommon in agreements like this. These members get to appoint designees to the board. That's what it's referring to, board designees. And then I agree with Your Honor, the language in 3.1 simply says, except for matters involving requiring supermajority approval, which have this certain voting requirement, any action approved by the requisite percentage, which is simply 51%. is deemed to be an action of the board. So consistent with Your Honor's comments, that simply means that, hey, in the normal case, 51% carries the day, except for in the context of supermajority approval decisions. And in supermajority approval decisions, there's this certain formula of governors who have to vote. The designee governor from either JABCO or 40 Ventures has to vote for it, and the designee of one of the other four, two of the other four, have to vote for it. That's the only difference. But both of those contexts are clearly votes of the Board of Governors. The real issue here is, then how do you get, once you're talking about the conduct of the Board of Governors, how do you get responsibility for what these governors are doing back to the members? Because unless you have a specific accepted theory to do that, you can't do it. And under the law that we've cited, there is no imputation of liability for a claim against the governor vis-a-vis the member. There is simply no law to support that. We cited the Kana decision, the Emerson decision, the Global Crossing decision, the Medical Self case decision, which all says it would turn corporate law on its head if you simply said because a member designated a governor, the member is somehow responsible for that member's comments. Now, in the reply memorandum, counsel cited three cases that he suggests are contrary to that. He cites the Carlson case, the Carr case, and the Ogus case. Now, these cases were not submitted to the district court, were not submitted in connection with the opening brief, but nevertheless, the cases have absolutely no application here, because in each of those three cases, Carlson, Carr, and Ogus, in each of those three cases, the claim was for aiding and abetting, the shareholders aiding and abetting the conduct of a director, right? It was in that context, they were directors as opposed to governors, but it was aiding and abetting, the shareholder aiding and abetting the conduct of the director. And the question became, under those circumstances, can you impute knowledge from the governor to the alleged aider and abetter? Here, there's no application for three reasons. The first is, there's no claim here against the director slash governor. There's no principal liability claim, so it fails for that reason alone. Second, there's no aiding and abetting claim against the members. It fails for that reason alone. And third, to be able to assert the theory that's discussed in those three cases, the claimant, the target, the member in this case, which is the target, has to be a non-fiduciary. And they've asserted in their complaint, or alleged in their complaint, that these members are fiduciary. So for those three independent reasons, those three cases, Carlson, Carr, and Ogus, don't apply. And they really didn't do any effort, put any effort into distinguishing Kana, Emerson, Global Crossing, or Medical Self, to say why those cases don't apply, and therefore why this imputation theory fails. There is absolutely no authority whatsoever for the imputation of liability under these circumstances. And to try to do it in the first place, you'd have to first assert a claim against the principal entity or person that would be liable, in this case, the governors. And there is no claim against the governors. They've taken great pains to say they're not suing the governors. So for that reason, this claim fails on its face. There's no way around it. Once you conclude that this supermajority approval section is a vote of the governors, the claim fails. Because the only way they can try and do something beyond that is to then try and assert some imputation theory, and they don't have it. So the claim fails for that reason alone. In terms of the direct derivative distinction, what counsel didn't address is the fact that this is really a claim of ultra vires acts by the board. That's what the entire complaint is. The board took action without requisite approval because they failed to comply with the supermajority voting requirements. It's a classic ultra vires claim case. The problem with that is, under the applicable statute 322B.22, which the other side doesn't take issue with in terms of its application, that section specifically says that to try and render a decision by the board to be invalid, it has to be done through a derivative claim. That's also what the Envoy case, the Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2003, says. And under those circumstances, the claim fails. For that reason, the claim fails. This is not a Medtronic issue. They, in their reply memorandum, they take issue with the application of Medtronic and say, why isn't this a Medtronic case? It's not a Medtronic case. In the Medtronic case, there was a claim for dilution of stock. And the Medtronic court said, in the context of a case with dilution of stock resulting from resulting in an expropriation of economic value and voting power, there can be the assertion of a direct claim. Here, there was no dilution. And as a result, that exception, that Gentile versus Rossette exception that was picked up in the Medtronic case doesn't apply on its face. The only other argument for Medtronic is if you said, well, can you go back to the general standard of Medtronic that refers to the injury and the remedy? Who is injured and who gets the remedy is the initial standard for direct derivative claims. Well, here, the claim that they have is that the company was dissolved. And we've cited cases, the Pure Body case and the McGee case, that say explicitly that that's a classic derivative claim. Claims that a company was inappropriately dissolved or the assets were distributed inappropriately is a classic derivative claim. And so for those reasons, the claim fails. So even if it doesn't fail for the first argument that they sued the wrong parties, it fails for the second argument that these are derivative rather than direct claims. They're completely separate and independent reasons. In terms of the tortious interference claim, I just spent a moment on that. In terms of tortious interference, just checking my time here, it's difficult to see. I actually can't.
I see 5 minutes, 53 seconds, counsel. Go right ahead.
Thank you. In terms of the tortious interference claim, their argument was simply that this representative of Waycross asked Mr. Montague to do certain things like sign a separation agreement and turn in his computer. And of course, it's undisputed that he didn't do those things. And so as a result, that person, and therefore the entity Waycross, did not procure a breach, could not procure a breach based on their own allegations. And they haven't said in their opening brief or the reply brief what breach was actually procured by this representative of Waycross. So for that reason, that claim fails. And then the only other claim they have in the case is this request for records claim, which is sort of the tail of the dog here. But in that, with respect to that claim, again, that, as Judge Klein held, that request initially was not made by 40 Ventures, but was rather made by Montague. And I think it's undisputed that it was made by him because he specifically said in his request that he was making the request as a fellow governor. And so as a result, 40 Ventures simply doesn't have standing to assert that claim. So unless there are questions that the court has, that concludes my remarks.
Any questions from the panel? All right, it doesn't look like it. Thank you very much, Mr. Marshall. So we will reset the clock for 5 minutes for rebuttal. And it looks like we're ready for you, appellant, if you're ready. Go right ahead.
So Judge Smith, you just talked about whether or not the word designees is in there, and we know that it is. It's in the definition of supermajority approval, where it specifically says that it is the designee of Jab Joe or 40 Ventures with respect to that special category of supermajority decisions. The next argument.
Go ahead. You go ahead, and then I'll ask my question. I'm sorry.
No, Your Honor, go ahead. I was
looking at, so when you know, the argument is is the designee limited to the governors, you're saying no, it's not.
Yep.
When I look at the contract, after the definitions, Article 2 starts with governors, and it talks about designating governors, and it defines the right of a member to designate a governor and when that might terminate, for example, at no such time as a member, or at such time as a member no longer has 50% of the membership units, et cetera. But is there anything in there that has similar limits or prescriptions around appointing designees?
So the word designee appears twice within the contract. The word governor appears dozens of times. And if we were going to give this great, importance to whether or not somebody was a designee on the board or not, then why wouldn't that contract say at least one of Jab Joe, and if you look at Article 2, they specifically identified them by name. Why wouldn't it just say Parker and Montague? Why wouldn't it say whoever is on the board of governors and has been appointed by Jab Joe and 40 Ventures? Why did it specifically delineate something different with respect to designees?
I'm not following. Delineate something different where? I'm sorry, I didn't follow
that.
Well,
if you go on Article 2, we're specifically using the names of the people that were appointed by each entity. So it was agreed by and among the members who the people were going to be on the Board of Governors.
As of that date, yeah. And then it had also, you know, description of how they get appointed above, et cetera. And as of that date, that's who they would be.
Yes, exactly. And that, and they have the a right to appoint one governor. And appoint is used. When you go back to the designee again, it's different. Why wouldn't they just use their names with respect to whomever the Board of Governor was, as opposed to using designee, when governor is used throughout the contract? And then on top of that, Judge Smith, my main point again, what, I mean, and again, when you back up from this, what difference does it make? If somebody is designated here to be on the board or not, they simply agreed by and among each other how they were going to allocate voting rights. It doesn't matter if somebody was wearing a special hat at the time and took the hat off. One thing council is right, we are complaining about ultra vires acts. They secretly went out to their office at Waycross and took this company away from two people that put all their heart and sweat into this thing, secretly did it, and then tried to get them to sign an agreement to do it. Now, Waycross specifically worked with the Cargills in order to try to take those rights away. Did they procure the breach? They were helping them every step of the way on this. The idea that they had to actually sign that agreement is nonsense. So if he signed something away saying I give away my supermajority rights and my right to designate somebody, do you think I might be hearing about that right now? Well, your client just gave up all these rights. How can you even complain about that? That is nonsense. It is the intentional procurement of that, and it's the work that they did hand in hand with these members of the board, with the Cargills, in order to take away my client's business. And they did it by ignoring the very agreement that they promised that they would not do this. They promised that they would not do any of those 36 things. And they violated it. And that's more or less undisputed. Nobody's saying that they, you know, that they haven't. And I know we're at a 12B6, but I'm saying if we were here at summary judgment, this is undisputed. They did it. And so now they're saying, well, listen, because we were convening a board meeting here, and because we were wearing we're clothed with the special authority, we get to use 303 in order to immunize everything that we did. That is not the law. There is no Minnesota appellate decision ever that has held on a breach of contract case that somebody was kicked out of court for a derivative case on a breach of contract. There is no decision like that. In fact, this court in unpublished decisions has said exactly the opposite, that it's a personal obligation. And because it's a personal obligation, it's unique to that person and you can pursue that as a direct claim. So I don't understand when we come back and forth on all of this as to why the designation of somebody being on the board necessarily matters. And I see that my time is up, so I'm gonna stop.
Our thanks to you, Council. We very much appreciate the arguments that we've heard today. Council for a respondent as well. The matter is now submitted to this court for its decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe.